Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
First of all, I just want to welcome you to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue, and thank you for coming out this evening and supporting independent and local businesses. It really does make a difference. As we are getting, as we as a country are going again, yet again, through this conversation about guns and what we're doing with things, what are we doing with all these guns, and what does it mean for us? I think this tonight's author is perfectly positioned for that in a lot of different ways. The two that makes the most sense to me are, one, he works on both sides, has interest in both camps of the argument. One being certainly as a gun owner, a longtime gun owner himself, he certainly has a deep appreciation for those, 40% of the American public that actually own guns, as well as either through political, politics, upbringing, temperament, he has a lot of, sympathy, resonance with the other side of that particular argument. So he has a foot in both worlds. Maybe that's the best way to say it. The other thing that I'd like to say is he's just a wonderful writer and journalist. Long time writer for a lot of different publications. Was a staff writer for The New Yorker, probably for the greatest stint, but has written for major magazines all across the country, major newspapers all across the country. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our author, Dan Baum, author of Gun Guys.
Well, thank you for coming. The genesis of this book, I kind of started thinking about it right after Barack Obama was elected the first time. And Gun Guy America was going crazy buying guns, kind of as they are doing now. And as he said, I am a lifelong liberal Democrat. I grew up in a Jewish suburb of New York, in New Jersey, just outside of Newark. All I've ever known is Democrats, raised by Democrats. I'm a lefty. I'm a big Obama fan. I'm totally on board with the whole lefty thing. But I have also been a gun guy since I was 5 years old, because I was a fat kid at summer camp, and the one thing I could do better than the other boys was lie on my belly and shoot a .22 rifle. Because we had a rifle range. In those days, camps had rifle ranges. And then, I'm 57. So back in the 60s, it was not unusual for boys to play Army and to have toy guns. I mean, I remember there was an E.J. Corvettes store near us. And the toy department looked like the armory at Fort Hood. I mean, it was just spectacular, the toy guns. And it was totally normal for boys to run around the neighborhood and play Army and cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians. So guns kind of worked their way into my psyche from two directions. There was this manly, serious discipline of marksmanship for 2 months a year at summer camp, and then 10 months a year of James Bond and playing Army. And so guns really set their hook deeply. And I've always liked guns. And when I was old enough, I taught myself how to hunt, and I hunt to this day. But I just like guns. I own what to some of you would probably sound like an appalling number of guns. Almost all of them are made before 1930. I'm an old gun guy. And I just like them, and I always have. But I live in this liberal Democrat camp, among people who would never say anything unkind about blacks or Hispanics or gays or immigrants or women, but consider it perfectly fine, even righteous, to say the most appalling things about gun owners. So I have spent a lifetime kind of feeling like a closeted gay man in a lot of conversations. And people would say, my people would say these things about my people, and I would just kind of stand there, and I would go to gun stores or gun ranges with the gun guys, and they would say the most appalling things about, my other tribe. So I've always had this kind of bifurcated life. And after Obama was elected, And, you know, Gun Guy America was buying a lot of guns, and Non-Gun America was laughing at the gun guys. I thought, it seemed to me that the NRA was making a lot of assumptions about gun guys that I just didn't think were true. And Dianne Feinstein and Charles Schumer and the rest of them were making a lot of assumptions about gun guys that didn't seem to me to be true. And I thought, you know, the one thing nobody's doing is actually listening to gun guys. I have never thought the NRA represented me, and I have known plenty of gun guys who do not feel represented by the NRA. The NRA got taken over in 1977. The NRA was not always the organization it is now. And it got taken over at the Cincinnati annual meeting in 1977. And it has 4 million members. There's probably 100 million gun owners in the United States. And while I'm sure there are a lot of gun owners who support the NRA without actually paying dues, I don't like the NRA and feel supported by it. And I've seemed to meet a lot of gun guys who don't feel particularly represented by the NRA. So it seemed like a lot of gun guys, maybe the majority of gun guys, for all I knew, were really not being listened to. And I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll just go out and listen to gun guys. I'll just get in the car and drive all over the United States and go to every gun store I can find, every range, every shooting event. I'll look for – and I decided ahead of time, well, I'll find a few representatives for the different kinds of gun lives there are. You know, I'll go find a concealed carry advocate, and I'll go find a sports shooter and a hunter and a Second Amendment activist. And I'll try to think of all these different ways that people like guns, and I'll go and get a few – I set up a few interviews along the way, so I had some direction. But mostly I was just wandering around and stopping. There used to be an app. They've taken it down since, called Gun Store Finder. And I would use that, and I would just wander across Nebraska on the little roads and go to – and some of these gun stores are in guys' garages. The really good ones are in guys' garages, actually. And but I had a problem before I set out. And that was, I was going to start driving around places like Nebraska and Kentucky and northern Michigan, asking gun guys about their gun lives. And I don't look like a gun guy. I look like a middle-aged Jewish man from New Jersey. So, and I'm going to have a hard time blending in. I mean, I could just see me walking into some gun store in rural Kentucky and, you know, trying to strike up a conversation about guns and just being frozen out. So I held my nose and joined the NRA, partly to get their magazine because I wanted to kind of keep up with what the NRA was thinking. But also I got this great little blue and gold cap that said NRA. I got one now. Yeah. And I put it on and I looked in the mirror and I realized now I look like a middle-aged Jewish man from New Jersey in an NRA cap. So this isn't going to work. And then I read about something online that blew my mind. It turns out, in almost every state in the union, although not in Denver — in Colorado this is true, but not in Denver — it is legal to walk around with a loaded pistol on your hip as long as it's in plain sight. You don't need a permit. Anybody can do, any adult can do this. And I thought, well, there's the answer to my problem. I'm going to, you know, nothing says gun guy like a gun. I'm just going to strap on a gun and wander around, and then I'll be one of them. So I thought I would try it one day. I got out of my safe the biggest, most ostentatious handgun I own. It's this big-ass World War I revolver, a big 45 caliber revolver in a holster. And I put it on, and you can imagine how ridiculous I looked. And I live in Boulder. So I got on my bike, and I rode my bike down to Whole Foods. And I thought... First, I was actually a little nervous. First, I went to Home Depot because I thought, well, this is kind of a manly place. And I walk all through Home Depot, and nobody says a word. Nobody even seems to look at it. And I'm watching. I'm paying attention, right? Nobody seems – maybe they thought it was a carpenter's belt, and they weren't really seeing it, you know. So then I went to Target, and I walked around Target, and nobody seemed to notice it. So I went and I stood right in front of this big fat security guard and played with the kind of, you know, the bargain bins for a long time with the gun facing him. Nothing. Well, this is getting kind of weird. I went to the Apple store and stood there for a half hour playing with an iPad. All the cute little people with their little rectangular glasses and their identical blue shirts. And nobody seems to notice this enormous gun on my hip. So then I went to Whole Foods because I thought, if I can't get a rise out of the people in Whole Foods. And I walked around Whole Foods for an hour. And I'm really watching, you know, and I'm seeing, is anybody kind of looking at me and like grabbing their kid and going to the next aisle? Or nobody was registering this enormous gun on my hip. And I can only figure that they were thinking that it's Boulder and their eyes were seeing it and their brains were discounting it and saying, well, that can't possibly be a gun. But I did feel, I got to tell you, I felt like a dick walking around with this thing. I just felt obnoxious with this gun. I figured I must be making somebody uncomfortable. And it felt really unsafe to walk around with a gun in plain sight. I felt, you know, some nutcase is going to challenge me to withdraw, or somebody's going to hit me on the back of the head when I'm not looking and take my gun. It felt very unsafe, so I decided to go home. I stopped at a little Mexican grocery store that I really like, and everybody in the store immediately was aware that I was there. And everybody wanted to know, ¿por qué la pistola? ¿Por qué la pistola? And everybody wanted to, you know, mothers are grabbing their kids and leaving the store. And like, and I don't know why that is. To this day, I don't know why. I mean, in Mexico, and these are not Mexican Americans, these are Mexicans. In Mexico, nobody gets to have a gun except the bad guys. And I don't know to this day. I don't know if the Mexicans were just more forward or if they really saw it and the Anglos in Boulder didn't. To this day, I can't really explain it. But I did discover that open carry was not for me. I felt unsafe doing it. So then I thought, well, I'll get a concealed carry permit because you can do that in Colorado. In fact, you can do that now in, I think now, every state. Not Illinois. Not Illinois, but Illinois is about to. There's a court case. When I started this, Wisconsin and Illinois were the only two states you couldn't. And here's the thing about concealed carry that I learned doing this. It used to be, for years, for generations, it was, the rule was, just about everywhere, if you wanted to carry a concealed handgun, you had to convince the police, you had to convince your local chief of police that you had a reason to carry the gun. I work late at night and I take money to the bank deposit window late at night, or I have a jewelry store or something, right? Or you were well-connected, because the well-connected have always been able to get a concealed carry permit. 20 years ago, remember Miami Vice? Remember, right? Well, the reason Miami Vice was Miami Vice was because Miami was the murder capital of the United States. It was in the late 80s, Miami was Dodge City. And most places that had high crime, Their reaction was, we got to control guns. If we're having a lot of gun crime, let's control the guns. Florida did the exact opposite. They did this very radical thing, and they said, no. If we're having a lot of gun crime, let's make it easier for law-abiding citizens to carry guns. And that way, they can defend themselves against the bad guys who obviously all have guns. And I remember thinking at the time, the good little Democrat liberal that I am, oh, this is going to be a bloodbath. This is a terrible idea. And they did it. And it was really popular. And it spread all over the country. So now, I think it's something like 40 states. That's how the rule is. That if you want to carry a concealed handgun, the burden of proof is on the state to prove why you should not have the gun, why you should not have the permit. It's called shall issue, as in the state shall issue the permit unless it can prove a reason why it shouldn't. This was really popular. Now, in the 20 years since then, violence, gun violence, murder have fallen in half in the United States. And this is something that neither side in this gun debate talks about, because the gun guys want to tell you crime is out of control, you got to carry a gun. And the gun control people will tell you, crime is out of control, we got to control these guns, when in fact, I can't think of a public policy success in my lifetime like this enormous drop in crime. I think it is the biggest, fastest drop in crime in the history of the United States. The gun guys will tell you it is because of shall issue. The bad guys don't know which good guys are armed. Therefore, they are more careful and there's less crime. I don't think that's entirely true, but nobody really knows. There's a lot of things have changed in the last 20 years that have reduced crime. Policing has changed. Demographics have changed. The economy has changed. The crack cocaine epidemic burned itself out. So I don't think there's a cause and effect. But clearly, we liberals who thought shall issue was a bad idea were wrong. It has not unleashed a bloodbath. This is all by way of saying I could get a gun permit. And I did. And it is the classes I took to get this gun permit were appalling. I could no more defend myself with a firearm after taking these classes than I could cook a souffle. I mean, it was ridiculous how bad these classes were. But I got my permit, and I got my gun. I took one of my guns out of the safe, I strapped it on, and I went off and did this book. And it was a thrill doing this book. It was so much fun going around the United States and talking to people. I mean, a lot of the people I talked to, especially out in rural America, a lot of them were not educated or not well educated, perhaps not particularly used to thinking on kind of a deep philosophical level. I don't know. But I would go around and I would stop in some little tiny town, a little gun store, a little gun range, or I'd see some guy out in back of his house, you know, with his gun, and I'd just pull over and talk. And I would ask these folks, we talk about a lot of things, but I would always get to this question, why do we like these things so much? What is the hold on us that these have? And I'd always kind of let on somehow that, you know, oh, I'm looking for a holster for this old Colt, you know, and I'd let on that, you know, I'm one of them. And these guys had answers. These guys loved thinking about this stuff. They would always do the same thing. They would always go, I would ask these guys this, and they'd always make the same gesture. They would always go, huh, I just like that. And they go, huh, like, well, that's a cool question. And I'm glad to be asked that finally by somebody. And I got a wide range of answers. I did not like all the gun guys I met. And if you read the book, I'm not asking you to like all these people. And I'm not asking you to agree with all these people. But I am asking you to hear these people, because the fondness for firearms is deep. It is complicated. It is rooted in, I think, a lot of extremely admirable impulses. And we can talk about that. There are yahoos out there. There are careless yahoos out there. I didn't meet very many of them. What came across over and over and over again was how seriously gun owners take their guns. And how much their firearms and their relationship to firearms means to them. And how clear it became to me that when people talk about gun control, we've got to control guns, what the gun guys hear is, we got to control the gun guys. They don't hear it as guns. They hear it as an attack on them personally. It became clear to me that a lot of the people I met were of a demographic that has fared very poorly in the United States in the last 30 years, and they're pissed. They're angry. Not only economically, but when I was a boy, all our cultural heroes were straight white men. James Bond and the Lone Ranger, and you know, that's who our heroes were straight white men. Today, the least cool thing in America to be is a straight white man. Everybody's cooler than a straight white man, right? So these guys have not only haven't had a wage increase since 1978. I mean, they're kind of that. I mean, the bulge of the gun guy demographic. Actually, if you look at the industry figures, the bulge of the gun guy demographic is middle-aged white men who haven't finished college, which is just the demographic that has really suffered in this country in 30 years. And these guys were angry often. And it seemed clear to me that they had a lot of good reasons to be angry. But in the United States, we don't talk about class, and it's kind of forbidden speech to talk about class. And to explain your own circumstances in our country in terms of class is kind of seen as making excuses for your own sorry ass. I mean, this is America. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so these guys felt a lot of anger. And the only people giving them an analysis, almost the only people, I mean, Glenn Beck was out there, but the NRA was there to tell them, you're pissed because the liberals want to take away your guns. And for gun guys, and it's not just the downtrodden and the, you know, I mean, I feel this. You know, I am an educated, liberal, urban, Jewish guy from Boulder. And even I feel this. And that is a distinct pride in being able to live alongside these very dangerous instruments, manage them, use them effectively, teach other people how to use them, and nobody around me gets hurt. And if you wear a gun, it's even more so, because when you're wearing a gun, if I'm wearing a gun here, I feel responsible for y'all if I'm wearing a gun here, right? And I've kind of have one eye over there, and I have one eye over there, and you don't know it, but I'm kind of looking out for everybody here. And gun guys, especially the ones who carry, they get a lot of self-esteem from that. And I think that's a good thing. You know, when I explain that to some people, they go, oh, it's penis compensation. And if you got to get your self-esteem from a gun, you know, what kind of man are you? But they're missing the point. I mean, to manage a firearm safely is like being able to drive a racing car safely. I mean, it's a skill. And it's a discipline, and they're proud of it. Another source of pride that I hadn't thought about, but I heard enough about and recognize that even I feel this as a gun guy, is in the United States, we have a unique relationship with our government. Our system of government places a tremendous amount of trust in us as people. And we all know this in the context of the First Amendment. We are trusted here. Say whatever you want. Print whatever you want. Say whatever you want on television. You know, our system of government says, we trust you. We trust you to know stuff about your government that people in other countries don't get to know. We trust you to criticize. We trust you to speak and publish and pray, assemble. And our system of government trusts us with guns. And this really came home to me. I'll tell you where this really struck me. I went to a machine gun shoot. There's a chapter about this in the book. Machine guns are legal. You can own a machine gun. You have to jump through some bureaucratic hoops, and you have to pay a little fee. And, you know, the big barrier to machine gun ownership is that they're wicked expensive. I mean, they, you know, like $30,000 kind of expensive. So it's rich guys who own them. But I'm out there in Arizona on this ridge, and everybody's shooting down into this swale. And it's just unbelievable the ordnance people have out there. I mean, big Soviet anti-aircraft guns and, you know, World War II guns and World War I guns and Vietnam era guns. And I mean, they're just chewing the place up. And I'm thinking, wow, look at this. No official supervision. These guys just come out here, you know, shooting up $10,000 worth of ammunition in a weekend. And it really struck me that, man, this is some country we live in, that we can do this. Now, some people might say this trust in the people when it comes to guns is misplaced. That's an argument we could have. But I can tell you that for the gun guys, this is a source of pride. As one guy put it to me, I feel like a bit player in American history, that just owning a gun makes me feel like I am participating in one of the things that makes this country I love so much unique. So I'm telling you all this because in the context of what's going on now in this gun debate, to the gun guys, they hear When legislators are saying, we're going to ban 30-round magazines. You can only have 15 rounds in a magazine. Or we're going to ban this particular rifle. The gun guys hear that as, wait a minute, you don't know me? You don't know guns? And you're telling me I can't be trusted with a 30-round magazine? What are you talking about? I mean, they don't hear it as, maybe this is some kind of, you know, first of all, we don't really believe that by adjusting the number of rounds in a magazine, we're really going to make society any safer. But it also just, so they wonder, if this isn't really going to make anybody safer, right? I mean, there's already 300 million guns in the country. So you're going to ban guns in the future. It's like, what are you talking about, right? You're not really going to make anybody safer. So there must be something else behind it. Nobody intelligent could really believe that by adjusting the number of rounds in a magazine, you're going to make us safer. So they must have something else going on. And what they have, and what they must have going on is they don't like me. And they don't like people like me. And they want to marginalize me and diminish me as a man and as a citizen. And I got to tell you, it hits them exactly in their most sensitive spot. And this is not just the people you imagine as the knuckle-dragging bubbas who are shooting up old refrigerators at the dump. I'm telling you, I'm one of them. I feel it. And it's volatile, and it's big, and it is really kind of not to be messed with. I was just in D.C. 2 days ago talking to some high officials of the Democratic Party, my party, which I support. And I was telling them, my brothers, I just drove around the United States, and I met again and again and again working guys, parks and rec workers, plumbers, electricians, guys who work in little eight-person factories on the edge of town in a steel Butler building, right? These are the people that the Democratic Party lionizes. These are the people that the Democratic Party has assembled itself to represent, the working man. And these guys will not listen to the Democratic Party about anything because of the Democratic Party's institutional hostility to guns. It is a catastrophe for the Democratic Party. And I was trying to impress that upon them, that it's not only a catastrophe for the Democratic Party, it's just wrong. It is just wrong to treat fellow citizens with that kind of disrespect. We don't get anything out of it. We're not going to make the country safer. So I was trying to explain this, and they were kind of looking at me like, these are inside the Beltway Democrats. I'm not sure they heard it. But this is powerful stuff. So when you're reading now about these laws in Colorado and these federal laws that are being talked about, I really understand. And I must say, on the flip side of this, I think my fellow gun guys have a lot to answer for as well. I think there's a lot of disrespect shown to the other side. I think there is an insufficient appreciation for how traumatized and grief-stricken the non-gun public is about things like Sandy Hook and Aurora, and insufficient respect and understanding of the intense emotional desire to do something. But what has happened now, because these two camps are so far apart, is I believe there are things we could do to genuinely make the country safer, because we're living among these 300 million guns, and that's dangerous, and we could do things that would make the country safer, but we're going to need the gun guys to do it. These are the people who know guns. These are the people who understand how they work and how they affect people and how they operate and how they can be stored and how they can – right? We need them. But what we've done is we've driven them out of the debate. Because as soon as Sandy Hook or Aurora happens, we start talking about banning stuff. The gun guys hear it as it's not against the guns, it's against the gun guys. They go into their defensive crouch. The NRA turns up the volume on its hate machine, and we're off to the races. And nothing is really going to change. We're not going to make anybody safer. So what I'm trying to do with this book, I mean, the first thing I'm trying to do with this book is entertain. I mean, it's kind of a hoot. I wrote it kind of for laughs. It's, I don't know if you remember Blue Highways or any of those road books. I went out to L.A. because there was, for a brief moment before Sandy Hook and Aurora, there was this brief idea that maybe my publisher thought maybe this could be made into a reality TV show, right? And I've got this little fat Jewish L.A. agent who's going, oh, I'm seeing Anthony Bourdain, but instead of food, it's guns. I like it. You know, and now after Sandy Hook and Aurora, no. Nobody's going to be doing that. But kind of keep that in mind. It's kind of like Anthony Bourdain, but instead of food, it's guns. It's me kind of wandering around haplessly meeting these people. And as I say, some you'll like, some you won't. But what I hope you come away from is that you share my desire for both sides to take a breath, listen to one another, and show each other some respect in this debate. So I would love to answer any questions, but here's a couple of ground rules. No speeches, please. We all have thoughts, and so let's not anybody stand up and make a speech, and let's be like respectful and nice to one another. Can I answer any questions, or should I keep yammering? Yes, sir.
You were talking about an anger out there, and part of the anger is, as you said, the liberals because they want to take the guns away. But aside from that anger, what is that anger? Well, because you say people are marked, where is that anger being focused, or is it real amorphous?
Well, you see it in the Tea Party. You see it in the fondness for Glenn Beck. But a lot of it revolves around guns, especially now. I mean, I'm now writing a piece for Harper's Magazine about the resistance to the new gun laws that are, right? And so I'm following this online, and I'm talking to people, and it's white hot, right? And it's white hot. It's this anger, and it's focused now around the guns. It's coalesced around the guns. I mean, there are times when we argue about abortion, and there are times when we argue about immigration. Now it's guns, and it's a convenient substitute. This is part of the problem with things like prohibitions. I wrote my first book was about the politics of drug prohibition, so I come to this with an instinctive aversion to bans anyway. I think when you ban stuff that lots of people want, you create the opposite of you get the opposite effect. I mean, right now, since Sandy Hook, I'm sure you're all aware of this, the AR-15 rifle, the big bad gun that everybody wants to ban, you can't get them anymore. They've tripled in price. We have put so many of those on the street. Look online. A really popular poster now that you see in all the gun stores is a big smiling face of Barack Obama, and under it says Firearm Salesman of the Year. So just talking about bans, we've put way more of these things on the street, way more 30-round magazines on the street than otherwise. But like drugs, the debate about guns is a stand-in often for bigger questions that are hard to talk about. And those, in the case of guns, are what is the role of the individual in this society? You know, what is the balance between the individual and the collective in this society? You know, what is a citizen? You know, what constitutes citizenship? I mean, these are kind of big, tough questions. You know, for a lot of gun guys, you are not a citizen unless you own a gun. You're a subject. You are at the mercy of whoever if you don't own a gun. So, you know, and a lot of my liberal friends, it's nuts. You know, there's a big debate. You know who's come out of the woodwork since my book has come out, and I've been on the radio a lot and been on television? The Jews. The Jews are splitting down the middle on this in this really interesting way. I was just talking today. I was interviewed by the Jewish Week on the phone in New York, and I had a piece in the Jewish Daily Forward. And what's going on with the Jews is kind of a microcosm of what's going on in the bigger society. I mean, there is one camp of Jews that is kind of the Upper West Side of New York, comfortable, you know, established, assimilated Jews who are very pro-gun control. Jews pull extremely strongly for gun control, except those Jews who are completely the opposite and say, you know, for Jews not to have guns is whack given what's happened to the Jews, right? Of course it can happen again. And each side thinks the other is completely nuts. Doesn't even recognize the, you know, and since my book has come, I'm hearing from a lot of Jews saying, thank God you wrote this. Thank God you've given me some cover. Now I can tell my wife I'm going to get a gun, you know. So that's been kind of interesting. But, you know, guns are a stand-in. I mean, you could almost call this book What We Talk About When We Talk About Guns kind of thing. You know? Yeah.
What made you come to the conclusion about what you said about the NRA this morning? Because all those guys were at work and we listened to you on Fox 31,
mm-hmm.
and we're like, oh, here we go. And then when you started talking, we were all, our jaws hit the floor.
What did I say about the NRA? That I don't like them?
Talking about basically about how it's basically a scare organization. Because one of the things is...
How it's what?
Basically sort of like a scare organization.
Yeah.
And one of the things that all of us guys that actually belong in the NRA, my dad's a life member, I quit being in the NRA, and Reagan decided to go a step further on the machine gun restriction, mm-hmm. which is, like you stated, the mm-hmm. tightest type of firearm to possess.
Mm-hmm.
When all this mess started with Sandy Hook and everything, they're like, why is the NRA not coming out for safe storage? You can't have the Hay Eagle program and be a hypocrite.
Right.
Because I can remember my dad coming home because I grew up with that.
You know, reasonable people can disagree on all of this, okay? So I'm just going to tell you kind of how I feel about it. I feel like the NRA is blowing it for us gun guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bad for the country. But the NRA, first of all, they've become the arm wing of the Republican Party. I mean, they are brutal on the Democrats. Openly, you know, half the country is Democrats, and a lot of Democrats are gun guys. So they've written off that half of the country. Zero outreach to people of color, zero outreach to women, zero outreach to young people. The NRA presents this angry old white man face to the country, and it's just completely off-putting. So you look at the industry figures, young people want nothing to do with firearms. I think this whole gun debate, 30 years from now, is going to sound to us like arguing about temperance or whether women should vote, because gun culture is going to vanish. Young people don't want anything to do with guns. And I don't totally blame the NRA, but the NRA isn't helping. And I think, because I like guns, and I like the shooting sports, and I think teaching young people to shoot is a really great focuser of the mind. It can be a great discipline for young people, and I'd like to see that continue. I think the NRA is kind of driving us the other way. Yeah.
Let me just preface this by saying 50 years ago, I was the president of my junior rifle club back in Ohio.
And it was a different time.
I was a crack shot that won a lot of trophies. What I want to know is why do you, and you're speaking for your gun guys, I assume you have a car, you have it registered, you have a driver's license. Are you worried that the government is going to confiscate your car or confiscate take away your driver's license? Why not have the same system for guns?
I was telling the Democrats, there are two red lines for gun guys. Most gun guys I know are fine with talking about universal background checks and fine with talking about all kinds of stuff. But there are two things that gun guys won't go to. One is banning stuff for all the reasons I talked about before, and the other is registration. The idea that the police have a list of everybody's guns makes gun guys really uncomfortable. And quite frankly, as somebody who grew up in the 60s and early 70s, back when lefties were suspicious of police power, I'm a little bit surprised that lefties are so hot now to hand the police so much power to know where everybody's gun is. Cars are different. I mean, gun guys, I guess you don't see it. I mean, gun guys talk a lot about having to overthrow a tyrannical government, right? And you roll your eyes. And I think most of them don't really think they're going to have to do that. But I've lived and worked in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in Mexico, and in Europe. I've lived in countries where the only people with guns are the military and the police. It's uncomfortable. It's a little weird. It's a little creepy. I lost half my family in the Holocaust. And you don't even have to go back to the Holocaust. 15 years ago, people who looked like us, wearing Benetton clothing, were lined up in front of pits and shot for being who they were. In Europe. In Bosnia. And they could not defend themselves. Now, it doesn't seem like it can happen in the United States. It really feels like it can happen here. But to gun guys, and that seems crazy to say it can't happen here.
They said that in Germany.
The German Jews, man, they couldn't believe it. They thought they were more German than Jewish. They didn't even think of themselves as being different. I mean, and Germany was the most cultured, educated, advanced society in the world. I mean, bad stuff happens. And frankly, as a lefty, I'm not comfortable with the police knowing where everybody's gun is, who's got a gun and what gun they have.
They know all kinds of things about us.
They do. They do. But they don't know about our guns. Well, they're 40% of the country, okay? I think if the Democrats, I mean, until Sandy Hook and the reaction to Sandy Hook, I kind of thought the Democrats had a chance of taking back the House in 2014. I think that's over now. So I ask my Democrat friends, you want to reduce the size of magazines from 30 to 15 rounds? What's it worth to you? Is it worth living with John Boehner? Not to me. So there's a cost. You know, when we talk about gun control, we only seem to talk about the benefits. This will work, this won't work. This will work, this won't work. We never talk about the costs. And there, as I learned doing this book, there are real costs to it. And if it's worth it to you, have at it. As a Democrat, it's not worth it to me. I want to win elections. I don't want these guys who are our people, natural Democrats, going to the other side because we dissed them on the gun question. So that's why I worry about their hurt feelings.
But isn't it education both ways?
Yeah, it is. Now, you know, registration, Canada had gun registration for years, and they abandoned it 2 years ago. Didn't work, and it was really expensive. So they just gave up on it. They just annihilated the registry and stopped registering guns. People don't commit crimes with the guns that are registered to them unless it's pretty clear who did it. Police show up and a guy is standing over his wife. We know who did it. But the bad guys, the people we have to worry about, registration doesn't get them. So it's kind of meaningless. It creates a huge bureaucracy. It's expensive. And it scares the bejesus out of people who can imagine the bad stuff happening. So it's just, you know, you may decide, well, that's all worth it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, after seeing, you know, I don't know how many basically vegetative bodies that are, you know, sitting in the hospital waiting to die because of motor vehicle accidents from motorcycles, it's just like people just want to prove, they just want to do what they want to do. And I think there are not that many areas left in the United States where you can do what you want to do.
You know,
so I think that they focus on these.
Well, you don't really have to be a gun guy in America to feel overmanaged and disrespected. I have some examples in this book. Once I got tuned to that by the gun guys, once I got tuned to that frequency, I started hearing it in all kinds of places. I know a neonatal nurse who used to keep in the pocket of her smock, I don't know what the name of the drug is, but it's a drug that if you need it with a newborn baby, you need it now. And now she can't have it in her smock. It's got to be locked up in a safe, and she's got to punch in a code, and she's got to sign a thing, and the baby could die. Why? Because somebody might abuse that drug. And so she's thinking, I'm a nurse. I'm a professional. And you know, why are you treating me like a child? Right? I can take care. You know, and I have other examples in the book. We are kind of overmanaged and disrespected as individuals. And the gun guys are way tuned into this. I had a conversation, me, the Democrat from New Jersey. I went to the Goldwater Institute in Arizona to talk to them. Because I was trying to figure out why is a fondness for firearms always found on the same chromosome as political conservatism? Why is that? And I thought, well, it isn't, but it often is. And it's associated in the popular mind with that. I mean, that's how I sold the book, because I'm a weirdo. I'm a Democrat gun guy. And this guy said something to me. I was expecting to go in there and sneer at these people, tell you the truth. I was expecting to go in there and, oh, I'm going to make something funny out of this. Goldwater Institute, right? Barry Goldwater. And this guy said to me, and this really clanged in my ear. He said, we are not Norway, where everybody's Norwegian, or Britain, where everybody's British, or Australian, where everybody's Australian. We are a big, polyglot, complicated country with a tremendous amount of personal freedom. And a certain amount of bad shit is going to happen. And if you try to engineer away all the bad stuff that might happen, you end up with a country you won't recognize. Other people said it was, other people put it like, there's no constitutional guarantee to safety, for safety. You want to be totally safe? Move to North Korea. We don't do safety here, right? We're a big, messy country, and we're allowed a tremendous amount of freedom to not wear a motorcycle helmet. And a certain number of people are going to rack themselves up, and we're going to pay for it. You know, people say after Sandy Hook, how can we make sure something like this never happens again? And the answer is, we can't. My first freelance piece I wrote in 1980. It was a piece arguing that the Berlin Wall would never fall, which is, you know, gives you an idea. Be that as it may, this German said to me something that really stuck with me. He said, "You're an American, God bless you. You think every problem has a solution." And that's really true for us. And in addition to that, we don't have a national church here in this country. So the only way we have to express our public morality, which many countries do through their national church, is we say there ought to be a law. That's what we do. And, you know, so we end up with a lot of laws. And we're just being messed with a lot. And the gun guys are really tuned into that. And I'm no less a Democrat than I was when I started this. I'm no less an Obama fan. I'm no less a tax and spend guy, New Dealer. But they taught me something about kind of what it means to be an individual. You know, it's really interesting. After Aurora, which was so hideous, the New York Times, among others, sneered at the idea that an armed citizen in that room would have made a difference. And they actually said, thank goodness there was not one of these crazy gun carriers in that room. Then there would have been two people shooting. And I'm thinking, yeah, there would have been two people shooting. What could possibly be worse than one person bent on mass murder with a gun and a room full of defenseless people? I mean, you go to the mall, there's an armed security guard. Why? We are hoping that in the event somebody does something bad with a gun, there will be two people shooting. There will be a gunfight. That's what we want. And it seemed to me that my fellow liberals kind of, and the New York Times, I love the New York Times, I read it every day, but the New York Times is kind of the Pyongyang Herald on this issue. I mean, one point of view is all that is allowed in the New York Times. But they just seemed horrified at the idea that any individual citizen could be independent, thinking enough, and vigorous enough, and capable enough to act that dramatically on his own. You know, they're saying, no, wait for the police. Wait for the police. That's why we have police. And the gun guys love to say, when seconds count, the police are only minutes away. Right? The police do keep us safer in the aggregate. But in the moment, when somebody is coming at you across a dark parking lot with a knife, or somebody's shooting up the school, they're not going to be there. We all wish there had been an off-duty cop there at Sandy Hook, right, with his gun, dropping off his kid, and he has his gun. He could have shot Adam Lanza or at Aurora. But the idea that ordinary citizens might take that kind of action on their own, it somehow seems to give my liberal tribe the heebie-jeebies. And I don't know why. And to tell you the truth, I don't like that impulse in us. So, yes, ma'am.
One would be whether you got a gun on you tonight as you're speaking, and the other would be how did you ultimately dress to get these interviews? You talked about, did you wear a mask?
Well, and answer the first question, we who took the concealed carry class, it wasn't a very good class, but the one thing we are drilled over and over and over again is you don't discuss it. Concealed means concealed. You don't discuss it. So if I was wearing a gun now, I wouldn't tell you. And I'm not telling you if I am. I'm not telling you if I'm not, because we don't do that. We're all safer. We're all safer if concealed carry people answer that way. You don't want concealed carry people saying, hey, look at that. You know, you don't want that. So we just don't discuss it. The other question was, I would dress, well, maybe not like this. This is a little fancy. But I would.
You were worried about it at first, and that's why.
Yeah, no, I just dressed, you know, I dressed. Like, you know, it was mostly summer when I was doing this, so I wore a big kind of Hawaiian shirt and cargo pants, mostly. And I had started out with a 6-shot 38 Colt Detective Special back here over my kidney, tucked into my pants in a holster. The gun was made in 1956, beautiful old gun, and the year I was born. And then that was kind of hot and heavy, so I got a I put that away and got a little 5-shot Smith & Wesson aluminum framed revolver, which was a little thinner, and I would carry it right here in a holster, in a pocket holster. Now, I never thought I was going to need the gun, so I was looking for the smallest, lightest gun. It was a fashion accessory, right? I got a guy in here. He's an African-American guy who lives in Detroit, an auto worker who got robbed at gunpoint and became a big concealed carry. He actually teaches it now. He wears this big-ass gun, right? Because he is all about – I was all about carrying. He's all about the moment he's going to need the gun. So he carries a big gun under – you know, and he keeps it concealed. He's careful. It's a big deal to carry a gun. I liked it at first. I ultimately found it burned me out.
Did you write a piece for Harper's?
I ultimately found that it kind of – now, if I lived in Detroit, I might feel differently. If I lived in New Orleans all the time, I might feel differently. You know, this question – another way to think about this. The people who tend to support gun control tend to live in really nice neighborhoods. And to them – it is as inappropriate for Charles Schumer to make self-defense decisions for a woman walking through the South Bronx after her 11 o'clock shift at night to the subway. It is inappropriate for them, or a guy living out on a farm. It is inappropriate for Charles Schumer to make self-defense decisions as it is for Mitch McConnell to make reproductive decisions for women. To them, self-defense is as it goes back to when we were in the trees. It's pre-Second Amendment. It's, you know, we are organisms, and organisms defend themselves. And it is a personal decision on the order of reproduction. So don't you, who lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, tell me, who lives in the South Bronx, I can't have a gun. You know, so they really, they can go on and on about that. Yeah. The thing about assault rifles, do you know what an assault – if I showed you an assault rifle and then I showed you a Remington hunting rifle, there is no functional difference. There is no functional difference. Assault rifles look nasty, but there is no functional difference. So we're having this enormous debate. First of all, assault rifles, they're used in 2% of homicides. They've been used in these big events. Because the AR-15 rifle, which is being portrayed, that's the big one that was used at Sandy Hook and Aurora, it is portrayed often as this kind of bizarre outlier. Like, who needs one of those, right? It is the whole gun business. The whole gun business revolves around the AR-15. It's the only gun anybody wants for the same reason that the iPhone is the only phone anybody wants. Because it is the most high-tech, advanced development of the firearm. They're amazing to shoot. I don't like them particularly. I don't own one because I'm an old gun guy. But
you don't go hunting with one.
Oh, sure you do. No, sure you do. Sure you do.
But the semi and the burst function. Not
there's no burst function on a civilian AR-15. See, this is part of the problem. This is what the gun guys hear. They say people who don't even know what they are want to ban them. And to them, and to them, to want to make rules about something you don't understand is the height of elitism. And that is the Democrats' Achilles heel, is our air of elitism. And so...
Do you have one in the Army?
Yeah, the Army has a different... Yeah, the Army has a burst function. Yeah, the Army has a burst function.
I still don't see that.
The other thing about it is they're Barbie for men. They're like made of Lego. You can take them apart and swap parts. You can change the caliber. So you can hunt elk with it or you can hunt coyotes with it. They are, as a consumer product, if you can separate, as a consumer product, they're awesome. They are awesome because they are so easy to shoot. Anybody can hit the target with them. There's no recoil. They're lightweight. There's a million things you can buy for them. So you know how gearheads are. You know how bicycle people are. You know how car people are. They're always buying stuff. It kills very few people. It killed 700 people in the United States last year in a country of 300 million people. So what I'm saying is, if it's important to you, have at it. Ban them. All I'm asking you to do is to consider the cost of what you're doing, the cost in adding this divisive element to American politics at a time when we are divided over everything. Do we really need – I mean, we're really not going to make anybody safer. So do we really need to have this fight? Yeah, yeah, actually, you. Yeah.
You talk to anybody that, in law enforcement that works the street, not the chief.
Oh, yeah.
Smiling and shaking hands with yeah. political parties.
Yes.
The guy who's going to respond to your school.
I talk to every uniformed officer I can find about this. I ask him about concealed carry, and I ask him about AR-15s. I have never had a uniformed officer say he doesn't support widespread concealed carry and doesn't oppose assault rifle ban. Cops are gun guys. Also,
reality.
Cops, yeah, and they're reality guys. And cops say to me all the time, I'm all for it, man. I can't be there. Carry a gun. You know, provided you get checked out. I'm a big believer that training needs to be a lot better. But that's kind of a narrow slice. Sir. It's called a New York reload.
Yeah.
That's what they call that.
I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
It won't make us any safer.
Right. And you know, what you also have to come back to is Timothy McVeigh. He's our biggest mass murderer ever. There was no gun there at all. So, and again, if we were having this conversation in 1940, maybe things would have been different. Maybe we would have done things differently and we wouldn't have all these guns. But the fact is, we got them. This is the reality we got to deal with. So you can talk about banning them in the future, but unless we're going to do a nationwide house-to-house warrantless search and round them all up, which I don't think any of us patriotic Americans want to see, what we have to think about, this is why I'm always arguing with the gun guys, stop talking about the Second Amendment. Who cares what James Madison wanted? The point is, what do we want? What do we want now with all these guns in this country? What do we want out of this? How do we want to live? And I think it's a better question to ask. Joel.
What did you find about gun gals, especially since it seems to be this main kind of political point?
A lot of them call themselves gun guys, for one thing. There's a woman shooter in here. Awesome shooter. She competes with a submachine gun. There's a whole sport built around submachine guns, and she competes with it. She looks just like Sarah Palin, too. She's really something. Kind of on purpose. And she's awesome. The NRA has been trying to get more women into shooting for years and years and years. And the number of women who participate regularly in shooting sports and own guns has been at 10% forever. Look, we who wear our reproductive organs on the outside, we like stuff. We're gearheads. We like tools and cars and bicycles. Toys, right? And guns are the ultimate toy. What gun guys would tell me over and over and over again is, tell me something else I can buy for $400 that my grandchildren will be using. The rifle with which I hunt was made in 1900 for the Spanish-American War. Works exactly today as it did then. They last forever. It's part of the reason why gun control is so futile, because we have all these guns and they're never going to wear out. So they are just beautiful devices. And that's more of a guy thing. Okay. Manage ammunition if it's important to you. All I'm saying is consider the cost. Consider the cost in anger and divisiveness and all that.
Well, I hate to cut off the discussion, but I have to. So first of all, thank you, Dan.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.